This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, and it's Tech Expert Day. And we're going to talk about how to manage another person's digital identity after they die. And back with us is Jesse LeGrew. He's an information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. And we'll also talk with him about common mistakes that people make with their home internet. How fast is your Wi-Fi? Are you having trouble with your router? Join in with your general tech questions by calling 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Welcome back, Jesse. Good to see you.
Glad to be here.
Excellent. Now, so we're talking about, you know, information that people leave behind on the internet and their computers, which we call their digital identity. Why don't you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, so everything we basically have on the internet, primarily the internet, is, you know, comprises a person's online life. It could be your bank information, it could be your social media accounts, could be email, could be a variety of different things. Usually it's going to be any external service that you're using that you need to log into that, you know, provides some kind of service. Social media is a very, very common example. But it's also really challenging this day and age to also not have some kind of bank account, credit card accounts, any other kind of financial account. So we have a variety of them just out there all the time. And for an active person on the internet, that might mean hundreds of accounts that kind of remain there, especially if there's no, you know, kind of policies in place by those providers to remove them after a certain amount of time. They might just stay there in perpetuity and just, you know, kind of float around in the cloud.
And what would be the danger of that happening?
There's a variety of things that can be a challenge. I know in the past we've also talked about, you know, credit freezes. So making sure to freeze your credit so no one can request information about your account and potentially try to request credit on your account. So kind of an aspect of identity theft and fraud that exists for individuals that are also deceased. So if someone does not have a variety of things closed out with credit unions, with Social Security Administration, or with a variety of other locations, it's possible to get credit on that individual's identity if that hasn't happened. It's also a reason why, even though we normally wouldn't think about it, if you have, you know, a newborn baby at home, or just, you know, a child that's, you know, under 18 or under a certain age to get their own, you know, financial accounts, their identity might also be used to get credit, which sounds really odd. But, you know, people actually have seen all of a sudden, you know, their children are grown up, they look to get their own account. It's like, well, it turns out they actually have a variety of accounts already open. They've also been extended beyond their means. And, you know, they all of a sudden have a credit issue that they otherwise wouldn't have expected. So kind of maintaining control over that identity, whether it's a deceased loved one or it's, you know, a child, is extremely important, because people can, you know, they'll use that information for whatever they can try and get away with.
That's a really good point, because I didn't even think about that. But yeah, because you're not using it. And so it's sitting out there. And yeah. So let's start with social media, because that's probably what people think about first. What options are available for managing that?
Yeah, there are a few options that are built into some social media platforms where you can designate a person, where if the account's inactive for a certain amount of time, this individual can either take control of the account, or maybe that account automatically expires, meaning that no one has to do anything. It kind of takes care of itself. Otherwise, if those controls really aren't in place, the best course of action is really to try and request access. So if you do have a loved one that passed away, the best thing to do in that case is to request access from that third party. Based upon, you know, the information that you have, they may require a death certificate or other information. But that's the, unfortunately, that's the best way to do it. And I say unfortunately because it can take time. even if you do know the individual's username and password, it may not be legal to access that account. You need permission in order to do it, even if you have the information. So planning is also an important step here. So if there is a will, or what a lot of people term as a digital will, that says these are the digital assets that I have, and these are the individuals that have access to use it, and this is how they can use it. At least it helps from that legal perspective. And if anyone is thinking of this, I would also recommend, contact a lawyer, get a lot of those things in place. There are also a lot of great free templates online that you can fill out. You don't have to do it from scratch or try to dig all the information up yourself. Use something that's available online. It at least gives you a really great head start. And some tools like password managers may allow you to easily share that information when that time comes. So somebody could have, all of the passwords needed. You know what accounts they do have because it's all in one centralized repository. It's the data tracking, keeping everything in one place, and then making that available to somebody else, which is important. And on that legality aspect, if you do have somebody's password manager that they did give to you after they pass, is it legal then to use those passwords to access the account? So I'm not a lawyer. I would be careful with doing that. There could be an implied consent based upon the platform that they're using and how they put that around. But it's always best to make sure that you have gone through appropriate legal actions, potentially in your city, in your state, in your country, because each of the laws are going to be a little bit different. And it's good to kind of check all of the boxes just to make sure that you're doing anything that doesn't put you into a questionable legal state. You want to make sure that you have appropriate permission and that you can do what you need to do. Usually, while it does feel urgent, things can also wait. So you don't necessarily need to have access to everything right away. It does take time to work on a lot of those items. And in some cases, you may also just decide not to. Maybe it's not worth the work to do anything. And usually there's not a large review of things such as emails to do after the fact as well. And that kind of, brings a different potential ethical question. If you have access, should you look? And there's a variety of reasons to consider looking or to not look. But one of the reasons to at least make sure you can retain some kind of ownership or take control of those accounts is just to make sure somebody else can't. That's really the biggest thing, is you want to be able to protect their identity and the assets that they have, and also their privacy, even post-passing. So finding ways to take control of that so nobody else can is a really good idea. And then closing out those accounts really for the same reason, just because they may not be needed in the future. And in the end, it might seem like a very small thing, but it saves resources. If we don't need it, we can kind of get rid of that and kind of clean up things after the fact.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I definitely should do that on some of my things. Let's just take Facebook. Now that you just have to go into your controls and look for that.
Yeah, you can go into your settings and you can also grant somebody else access to your account. And they do have a memorialized feature within Facebook to allow the page to remain open where people can either read it or they can comment. And that is also something you can do with your own Facebook account. So if you do have a loved one that passed, you can also request that memorialization, even if you don't have direct access to their account. It's just a little bit more paperwork, and usually they can get you access relatively quickly with the correct paperwork in place.
Okay, good to know, because I know I've got a number of friends on Facebook that have passed, and it's kind of nice when their birthday rolls around and you have fond memories and remember them. So, great option. So let's just talk about what's on your actual computer at home, your laptop, your PC. And that's usually password protected too. So what should someone do if they have someone who died and they need to get in there? What's the best way to do that?
Yeah, and this is, I guess, legally where it gets a little bit more questionable. Whenever you have physical access to anything, generally you're going to have pretty easy access to the data on that device. Some devices come encrypted, and you might need a passcode to unlock that device. In those cases, if you don't have the passcode, you may not be able to get any of the data. That may or may not be a concern. Maybe the privacy outweighs any need to get to data on that device. But it might be really, really challenging, if not impossible, to get that information from it. However, in a lot of other cases, the hard drive or the data may not be encrypted. You can easily open it. You can read through the information and maybe look for artifacts that you need to, in terms of, well, I need to know what accounts they have, so I might want to look at their browser history to find out what were they logging into. That comes with its own dangers as well, since it's a person and it's their private information. So I would always, be careful about potentially doing that yourself. You can always request from a third party, which might help you sift through that information in a more impartial way to help you find what you're looking for in a way where you might also not uncover something you don't want to see. And I think that can be a great service to have, especially if, somebody doesn't have the technical knowledge or just doesn't really want to know. Like I might want to know exactly what I need to do for this one thing. I don't need to know more. Their private life is their private life. That can help quite a bit. And there are third-party companies that help with data recovery and a variety of those items. And actually, that might also be another great recommendation for contacting or having an attorney where you can contact, I'm looking for this kind of service. Mm-hmm. What companies do you recommend for it? But that also helps to give other legal advice if there is ever any question. Is it legal to look at this or to access the data in this manner? And usually, there are court systems in place to kind of give you access to different resources. Once those are done, if you are granted access, you're granted access. Then it's just, how do you want to go about doing it? Do you want to do it yourself? Do you want to allow a third party to do it? And a third party actually can be extremely useful because for most people in that situation, it's already overwhelming. And it could uncover a lot of things that it could be very, very challenging to kind of come to terms with. And that third party could be really, really helpful.
That makes a lot of sense. Thanks for all that information. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Clara Neipert is our on-air producer today. And Trina LaSousa is our technical director. And we're talking with Jesse LeGru today about, he is the information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. And we were just talking about what to do if someone in your life passes away and you need to get at their digital files. But we can also take questions about that, but we can also take questions about other tech things that you have on your mind. So join in by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And we've got a number of lines open, so feel free. So before we go on to another topic, Jesse, just kind of briefly, so those of us who are still alive and want to make sure it's easier for when we go, what are some of the things that we should have in place?
Let's just have a written plan of who is going to kind of take control of assets, digital or physical, when that time comes. And have it written down, have it easily accessible. And this is also where either having an attorney or a third party to keep records of that is really important. But it's also good to let the individuals know that might be responsible for it, that they will be responsible for it and where to go when they do need that information. So trying to be as transparent as possible and as open as possible with what those plans might be and have it written down and, having an attorney or a third party to help you review and also give suggestions can be really helpful, especially when thinking about our online lives. It's hard to recall all the accounts that we have. So having somebody say, "Hey, did you think about this account? Did you think about this? Did you think about this?" And there's lists, all over the internet on different accounts to consider when that time does come. But also having something like a password manager, or having it where some of those assets and the keys to all of those things are easy to retrieve, is also important. It honestly could be a notebook with, accounts, passwords, everything written down and accessible from a third party. That's a way to do it. You can also have a password manager that's more easily to access online. But it really is just about knowing who those contacts are going to be. Preferable to have more than one, just in case something does happen to one of those individuals. And then to write down as much as you can in terms of, here's what you'll need to access. And usually it's going to be the important accounts. Email is really important because, especially for all of our online accounts, it tends to be a recovery mechanism. So email's a great thing to have. Phone is another good one because we might have multi-factor authentication or texting, and it might be another identity proofing method. And then bank accounts. Those are going to be another important aspect to keep control over. So even if just focusing on those main items, make sure somebody knows what they are, that you have written down who gets access, and having an attorney to at least keep it and properly approved, so it can make that process easier, is even better, because otherwise the legal process can be challenging. And so having an expert give you more guidance and to help you through that can really be a time saver, and it can just alleviate a lot of the burden.
A blessing for those who are left behind, because we, unlike the internet, won't be around forever. So thank you for that. Let's go to the phones. And we do have open lines, 800-642-1234, if you have a question. And we've got Fred in Wheaton, Illinois, I'm assuming, Fred?
Wisconsin.
Oh, Wisconsin. Okay. What's up?
Yeah, could you recommend a basic level of antivirus spyware security program for PCs? Preferably free. In the past, I've used AVG, and they have a free version that was at one point simple, but like many things, it's become junked up with ads and come-ons to upgrade all the time. Could you also maybe discuss the importance of that of antivirus anymore?
Okay, lots of questions.
Antivirus is still one of those necessities for basically any device. Even if we think that Windows is the most attacked, there's still ways for malware to move from system to system, even if it's not meant for that system. So, including phishing emails and a lot of those bad things. So, antivirus programs are still a necessity. For any device that you're using, especially if you're using it for banking, email, and a lot of other sensitive items. In terms of free antivirus for Windows, I guess first I'll just comment on free or pay. Usually, if you're paying a little bit more money, you're actually paying for a little bit better service. So there is also a potential benefit to pay for a more robust solution that can give you additional benefits. And this does happen with a lot of different antivirus or anti-malware companies. They may also offer you VPN services or other privacy services that actually could be a really, really good benefit. While free options are always good, consider paying, because you actually might get a little bit more for that money. If you are using Windows 10 or 11, which is the two most recent Windows operating systems for day-to-day end users, the Windows Defender platform that's built into Windows is actually really, really good. Microsoft has gotten a lot of comments about their security over the last several decades, but they've also done a really great job in improving their products. And actually, Windows Defender that's built in, it is automatically updated. It is a good amount of protection, but you're also being able to leverage the data that Microsoft is also feeding from everyone really using the platform. So they're able to actually take that data and do great things with it. So I do recommend using Windows Defender. It's a great platform. It is built into Windows. And if you are using Windows 10 or 11, there are also additional security features you can turn on depending on your version of the operating system. So if you're using like a Windows Home version versus a Windows Enterprise version, some of those features are a little bit different, but do take a look at your security settings because they might have additional options you could turn on that are free. You just have to hit the on button and you can take advantage of it. So I do recommend Windows Defender. It's free and built in, continually updated. Otherwise, if you are looking for other options, I mean, Avast, AVG have been options that are lower cost, but they are, it is an option where I would consider investing in a product that might also give you other services, such as VPN, such as privacy, and they call it privacy protection. It's really something that might help you understand whether your data was made available on the internet. So, you know, it can, is your name associated with data that's been leaked, for example. And usually it's something where they're using something called open source intelligence. They're looking for data on the internet. If they see your name, they want to let you know about it. A lot of tools will have that kind of built in. But I do think Windows Defender's good for just about everyone. Just make sure it's turned on. With any antivirus product, limit the exceptions that you make. So you can say, don't scan this or don't do this. The more times you create exceptions, the more chances there are for something to use those exceptions to their benefit. And so you might accidentally download something that could actually infect your device because of an exception. So I'd always be careful of that. And if you do have more sensitive things to do, there are, you know, potentially use a different device. Use something called a virtual machine. There are free guides to do that. But I think Windows Defender works well for just about anyone. But there are a variety of other products out there that also came as, you know, trying to stop browser plugins and other things that were bad, but that actually may offer more fully featured antivirus products today. So there's a lot of great options out there, but Microsoft, I think, is doing a great job with their platform and recommend using it if it's built in.
Okay, thank you for that question, Fred. And I have to chime in, Jesse. You saw me shaking your head when you said Avast, because I took that advice from somebody. It wasn't you. Put it on the free version. Didn't act very well at all with my computer. It's a PC. So I was like, okay, I'll buy it. Bought it, and it was a disaster. I had to take it to a store and have them take it off because it was everywhere. And so anyway, there's two sides to every coin. So just want to share that with our listeners here.
Yep, that's definitely good feedback to have too. And with any product that you buy, one thing I always do take a look at is I take a look at reviews. So even if you do have a list of here are the you know five best versions to use, take a look at the research, see what other people are saying, and look for multiple sources because if you get one source of information, you might be missing something valuable in one way or another, where it's actually good or bad. So make sure you always take a look at multiple pieces of info and do your research to make sure you're getting the best product that you can get.
Absolutely. What questions do you have for Jesse? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. And you can send us an email. It's ideas@wpr.org. And we do have an email from Craig in Madison. He says gaining access to a relative's digital footprint is often needed before death, for example, in cases of dementia. All large internet-based services respect power of attorney, but there are many smaller ones where your only option is taking control of through your relative's login. And he often wonders about the legality of that. And I know you're not a lawyer, Jesse, but what's your comment on that?
Yeah, and the only thing I could recommend is working through a lawyer is actually a really great idea because they deal with this all the time. So I think that can be a really helpful outlet to one get additional advice. But they actually might have processes already in place to help you gain access to those other resources. And you may need to actually use the account to do something. It's just how do you get access to that account to do something, whether it's getting their password reset. Even if you know somebody's username and password, having that explicit permission to use it is really the item that might be the most challenging. And sometimes we don't get notice. You don't have that opportunity to kind of plan ahead, which is why I always, I'm asking myself, I should plan ahead. So anything I can do ahead of time, I think it, while I'm well, I think it's a good thing to do. But having, an attorney or legal recourse is always a good idea. And if you do need to request it from that third party, there's always the request process that they do have. And power of attorney is another interesting item because there are many different types of power of attorney. So even if you have a general power of attorney for health, that may not include other assets such as property. So just being cognizant that there are different powers of power of attorney paperwork out there depending on the state. That's another thing to navigate. Once again, a great thing is to have an attorney that actually specializes in that because they can give proper guidance in terms of what to do or help with the court system to ensure that you have access to different resources when needed. Really, that they're going to be the legal experts and they're also going to know how to navigate the system, which I think is one of the most challenging things to do because there's a lot to do and even thinking I have a power of attorney for this thing, and you find out, oh, that doesn't actually cover everything. I didn't anticipate that. That's one of those things that they can definitely help out with. There's, at least for Wisconsin, there's a variety of resources through Department of Health Services where you can get a variety of paperwork and forms that are templated out that you can fill out. But if that individual is not able to sign that paperwork, well, you're kind of in that situation where you need something to happen before you can act, but you can't because they can't actually do anything about it. And so, once again, attorney is going to be probably your best resource because it really is navigating the legal landscape. Because in this case, it's all about permission or how you can be delegated authority when something does happen. So I would. Just be careful when logging into somebody else's account, even if they say thumbs up, go ahead and log into my account, without having a paper trail and a variety of other things, it can open you up to, other legal risk.
Okay, thank you so much for that question, Craig. That really brings up a lot of other information. And just as an FYI here, we do have a show coming up in April, like we do every year, with some representatives from the Wisconsin Bar Association, whatever the legal name is, but they will answer questions, and there's also paperwork there too that you can get for free. So lots of options out there, but the point is to do it. So, all right, let's go back to the phones. We've got Ron in La Crosse. Hi, Ron.
Yeah, I have a question. I have an older Mac Mini. It's a mid 2011 model, and I've had the operating system upgraded several times with Apple's website. The latest version is High Sierra. But I can't upgrade to the new operating system Apple's offering because it's an older model. It's not compatible, which means I, in turn, cannot install the latest version of Google Chrome, which is the one that has the security if I wish to access my financial accounts online. So what do I do? I have to get another Mac or maybe just go to Microsoft laptop?
Yeah, that's a good question, and that's a challenging one. So, at least to get updates for the Mac Mini, I mean, you already kind of ran into the roadblock that you expressed. There really is no other good way to get updates outside of getting a new Mac or maybe getting a new PC. So, really, a new computer that is supported from a hardware perspective to allow you to get all of the software updates is really what's required in your case. So, that could be another Mac, that could be a PC, it could be Google Chromebook, for example, depending on what you need to do on a day-to-day basis. And they vary in cost. Google Chromebook tends to be pretty cost effective and can serve most people's day-to-day needs relatively easily. There is another possibility, although it's a bit more challenging and due to the age of your device may not actually work well, which could be using a virtual machine on your Mac Mini to run a different version of Windows or something else. Probably not going to work out too well just based on the age of your device and what resources are required for those newer pieces of software. So, in this case, the best solution I have is to get a new device, whatever it is, really to make sure that you have the latest support and software updates that are needed. And overall, it's going to run better. The device is, at this point, 12 years old and might work fabulously. But once you get that new device, it's going to work a whole lot better as well. And you'll get all the updates.
There you go. My Mac is a great DVD player when I couldn't update. So anyway, so let's go to, before we go to Mary and Madison, we'll be right back to you. But you had mentioned virtual computer a couple times, Jesse. I'm not familiar with what that is. Could you explain it?
Yeah, they call it a virtual machine.
Really
what it is, it's, I might have a laptop or a desktop. It's running Windows or Mac OS. Well, you can also run a virtual machine, which is kind of like what we call the physical machine you have in front of you, the device that you're interacting with that has your keyboard and mouse plugged in, but it can run actually within that physical machine. So it can actually be a program. You might be used to opening a web browser. It might be Edge, it might be Safari, it might be Chrome. You can load a program that's actually a virtual machine. And so it's actually running an entire computer within your computer, which sounds kind of weird. So, you're kind of getting into the inception of a computer within a computer within a computer. But in the end, it's a way to run a fully functioning operating system that could be running Windows, it could be running Mac OS, which if you're running on Mac hardware, in which you can do everything you can do on a physical machine. But you're also sharing the resources that you already have on that physical machine. If you have a device that doesn't have a lot of memory or a lot of processing power or a lot of storage, you may not be able to do it, may not just have enough space. But if you have a very powerful computer, you might be able to run multiple virtual machines, meaning that you could actually have four computers running at the same time, all independent. One of the benefits for using those kind of virtual applications is it gives you a space where if something breaks within that machine and you shut it down, it broke within that machine. It didn't break outside of your machine. So it does help you kind of isolate the data that you're sharing. It also gives you a little bit of extra protection if navigating to a questionable resource that might give you malware because it's not going to be sharing it with your physical device. So for those that are a little bit more tech savvy, a virtual machine can allow you to do things in a little bit more flexible manner. And you might have extra capabilities where you're not sharing or putting at risk other data you have on your physical device. Okay. So great option. And there's great free resources out there for it too.
Oh, we like free. Well, thank you for that explanation. It kind of helped. I think you have to really have a tech brain for some of this stuff, but maybe we'll revisit it a few months down the line when, it applies to something else, as it always seems to do. And Mary and Madison, thank you so much for being so patient. What's your question for Jesse?
Hi, Jesse. I just bought a new printer, and I was trying to load it onto my computer. So it won't do it because it says I have to use 2.4G something for hooking it up, and my internet is 5.0G. However, my router shows 2.4 and 5.0, and there's a green light by both. I don't understand why I can't get this to hook up.
Yeah, and I'm guessing you are hoping to hook your printer up wirelessly, correct?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. So the 5G or 5 gigahertz and 2.4G or 2.4 gigahertz, they're two different frequencies to access wireless. And usually, a long, long time ago, they used to be designated by letters. Now they're usually designated by numbers. So you might have Wi-Fi 5 or 6, and you might have those different frequencies. It sounds like your router's capable of both 2.4 and 5 and has both enabled. and it sounds like the printer has 2.4 that it can use, it's possible that your computer is actually using 5. And so what you might need to do, if hooking your computer to your printer, you might need to change it to the lower frequency. It does depend on how the printer is working, whether you're connecting directly to the printer or whether the printer's connecting to the router. It can happen a variety of different ways. But usually if you're on a wireless connection on your device, what you can do under your wireless settings, usually it will tell you what frequency or what strength you're getting from your different wireless networks. Excuse me. And you might just want to change it to the lower frequency. It depends with your device whether you're going to have that capability. Usually you are. If you have version 5 available, I would be kind of surprised if you wouldn't have 2.4 available. But it's likely you're going to need to switch your computer to the other frequency. And depending on whether you have a Mac or a PC, it's going to be in different locations. But usually it's going to have the same like a wireless icon. So the wavy lines, you have about 5 of them. When you click on it, you'll have options to select your network and to select the frequency. So I'd recommend trying to change it to 2.4 and then see if you can connect to your printer at that point. You can find different guides online with how to connect to the different versions. Your internet service provider might also be able to help you as well, because it's likely they gave you the device that does have version 5 and 2.4 available. They can probably walk you through it over the phone as well to kind of make sure that you can change it. But it sounds like your router's capable. It sounds like the printer's capable. My guess is your computer's just on 5 gigahertz. You just want to change it to the 2.4 gigahertz version. And then I'm hoping after that, you'll be able to connect and everything will work. I would, if it does function, I would keep an eye just on your internet connectivity. It shouldn't slow down your internet. Likely you won't notice too much, but one of the reasons they do have the differences between 5 and 4 is to work better over certain distances or to give you greater speed. So you might notice a difference. Most day-to-day users, you probably won't. And switching to 2.4 will hopefully fix the issue.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mary. Just had to go through that myself, and it was not difficult. So good luck. Back with us today is Jesse LeGrew. He is an information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. What tech questions do you have? Give us a call. All the lines are open. 800-642-1234. And you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Coming up tomorrow at 11, we'll talk about the physical and mental benefits of walking. And then at 11:45, we'll hear about this year's Global Health Symposium. That's tomorrow starting at 11 on the Ideas Network. Right now, we are talking tech with Jesse LeGrew. If you've got a question, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And we've got Betsy from Madison with a question. Hi, Betsy.
Hi, Joe. Jesse, my question is about my printer, and I always print in black ink, using black ink, in the draft mode, just because I want to save as much ink as possible. And yet, I deplete my color cartridges. Can you help me understand why, if I'm only ever printing in black, why I'm using up my color cartridges? Thank you.
Yeah, that's a great question. So it depends on the printer. So some printers might use other colors if you are using black. In other cases, which is probably more common, when you put your cartridges in, and this is very common for inkjets, when you put your cartridges in, they kind of have a countdown timer, like almost a lifetime timer. And once that lifetime runs down, you might need to replace your cartridges. And that could be for a variety of reasons. One might be to make sure that the cartridges don't dry out, because they can. So if you don't use them, That is a possibility where they will dry and you simply can't use them anymore. Or it might actually be using combinations of the colors to create black. Unfortunately, I don't have a great recommendation in this case. I think you're doing what you can do to try to save on the resources that you already have in terms of black and setting the appropriate settings. And depending on the printer, there might be an option to not use color cartridges if you are trying to create black, because there are different ways to do that. That setting may or may not exist for your printer, and it might just do that by default. You might not have options, or it might be an aspect of the countdown. I would check your printer settings just to see if there is an option to not use color unless color is needed, because it might be possible where it's trying to use those to actually create black rather than using your black cartridges to create black, which sounds unusual, but it's a possibility. And so in an odd way, that can also be used to conserve black, but it doesn't help when you actually want to use color. So take a look for that setting. I have not actually seen that on printers that I've used in the past, but I have seen it where the cartridges do have like a longevity meter. And once that meter runs out, the only thing you can do is to replace it. Even when you get cartridges, they're not the simple cartridges that they used to be 20 years ago. You will see they will have little chips so they can read data from it. That information might actually contain some of that data in terms of expiration, where it might require you to get a replacement. So the only thing you can do if it's not any of those settings potentially would be to get another printer, like a completely different kind of printer, which is a whole different issue. But that would be, you know, the only other option that I could think of. But if the printer's working, keep on using it the way you're using it. You might also find out that there might not be a need to really use draft anymore, and that you might just want to use it using, kind of the standard ink usage. It's also possible, without doing research, that the draft mode might actually offset black usage to color rather than using black. So it depends on your interpretation of it. So I would check the manual for your printer just to validate what that draft setting actually does, because it might act differently depending on the printer. And hopefully it's not the expiration with the cartridges, but if that is the case, there's limited things you can do, unfortunately.
Yeah, excuse me, Betsy, good luck with that. I had the same problem. I finally just said, forget about it. Got a new, is it an inkjet printer? Or not inkjet, what's the other one? You've got the cartridge.
Laser.
Yes, so I did that. But I did have a setting where you could change it to just the black cartridge on mine. But what that color does is just makes it look richer, and most people can't tell. So it's, yeah. Anyway, thank you, Betsy. Good luck. Let's go back to the phones here. Jim in New Berlin. Hi, what's your question?
Hi, I have a recently bought iMac, and it started out okay, but now it's very, very slow. And I wonder what I might have done wrong. It's slow on startup and slow when you first want to start up Safari to get on the internet. Is there anything I can do to speed it up?
There are probably a couple things I'd look at. Once you're on Mac OS, they should have an application called Activity Monitor. That's a great application to open up. It will tell you what's running on your computer and what resources it's taking up. Usually with slow performance, I'd consider a few different causes for it. One might be, your computer's working too hard. There's something in the background doing something that is just taking up all the power and it's not allowing you to run other processes. Usually in those cases, I would actually consider there being bad software on it. It could be malware. It could be something doing something you really don't want. Could have been software that you downloaded or installed, or it could just be something that might need an update to resolve that issue. And that does happen every now and again. Another item I'd look at, and this is also on the Activity Monitor, and when you're in there, you can usually sort by like CPU, you can sort by memory, but memory would be the other thing I would look at. What processes or programs are taking up the most memory? If your memory is also running short, That's essentially what all your programs run on. If they don't have enough memory, it asks you to use the hard drive, and it's a little bit slower to do it. So if something's taking a lot of memory, that could also cause slow performance. So take a look there, and if you do have something that you don't think should be there, you can usually hit end process or end program. Maybe you can uninstall or reinstall the program to hopefully solve the issue. The third thing I normally take a look at is a potential hardware problem. So maybe all your software is working exactly as it should. You have no high process usage. You have no high memory usage. Everything looks normal. It could be there's an issue physically with your memory that it's not allowing all the memory to be used because there's, you know, you have a faulty stick. Or your hard drive is actually having issues, which can also cause that same slowness because it's needing to compensate with bad areas of your hard drive. With newer systems, it's a little bit more interesting because a lot of those, especially now, kind of come built into your motherboard. So if it's actually on your device, you really can't swap them out. They're not easily things you can just take and replace. But if your Mac is new, it's probably covered under warranty. And if that's the case, then you can go through either through an Apple store or even calling up Apple and run hardware diagnostics, which might be built into your device, or you might need to have somebody else run it for you and they might be able to run it for free. But first I'd take a look at what's running, taking up CPU usage or memory usage. If those seem normal, I would look at hardware, see if there's a hardware problem. Contact Apple, just validate your warranty, and they'll usually give you some steps you can take to check those components, or you can take it into an Apple store and they might be able to help you run those diagnostics just directly once you walk in the door.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, Jim. Appreciate that. Let's go next to Jill in Milwaukee. Hi, Jill.
Hi. Hi, Jesse. I have an iPhone, which is no longer, you know, in warranty. It's a 12 mini with the 16.3 and the 16.3.1. There's a known problem with backing up to iCloud. I wondered if you, I know you don't work for Apple, but do you think the next update might fix that? I don't know. It keeps telling me I don't have enough storage, which I know is not right. It started with that 16.3 update.
Yeah, and I know there is I think there's a 16.3.1 that was just released over the last few weeks, I believe. It is always possible if you do have an issue that a software update is going to fix it. So if you do have the problem now and it's a bug, it is very possible that they'll fix that bug once the next update does get released. If you do have 16.3, or I think it's 16.13 or 16, I can't remember anymore. But if you don't have the latest version, check it, update it. It might resolve the issue. Otherwise, I would take a look. And it sounds like you've already done this. You know, double check your storage, see how much free space you currently have, and then kind of go from there. I know syncing with iCloud, I think you only get 5 gigs, I believe, if I remember correctly. That could be, you know, a possible bottleneck. So maybe there is space on your phone. There's just not space on iCloud. So your iCloud account might actually be the area that's running out of space. I would recommend logging into your iCloud account with a web browser. So go to your normal computer, log in. It will also tell you the different things it has synchronized with iCloud. It will also tell you the storage, which I think can be helpful when you can kind of see, this is the storage from your phone. This is the storage for iCloud, because they are likely different. And your iPhone is going to have far more storage than your iCloud account is going to. If you do find out your iCloud account actually is full, well, there's a few decisions, which is to buy more storage or remove some data.
Okay. Well, hopefully that helps you, Jill. We've got about a minute and a half or so before we have to go to the break, but a listener just emailed us wanting to warn people that they had gone to the Best Buy website because they wanted to make an appointment to have their computer fixed. And while they were there, they got a pop-up claiming to be the Geek Squad and that they could check it, you know, remotely. And apparently, she kept asking him, are you the Geek Squad, and they said yes, they weren't. Long story short, they were a ripoff, and the company is Geek Care Global. The listener talked to Best Buy, and they were sorry, but they couldn't do anything about the pop-up. The minute we have left, Jesse, do you have any advice for people when they get pop-ups? You just close them out and be done with it?
I would just say have a natural suspicion, ask questions, and think about what it could be from. We have seen, even with Google Ads, there's been malicious software being released through that. So in an environment where you can pay to get an ad and make something bad on that ad, it's kind of a continually dangerous area. So just be mindful, always potentially research it from a different device and see, is this valid or not? But definitely be careful, because it is very possible to get bad pop-ups out there.
Okay. And thank you so much for that, listener, for letting us know about that. We really appreciate that. And if you've got a question, give us a call, 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. And we'll be back to take more of your questions right after this break for the news. We're talking about technology today with our regular guest, Jesse LeGrew. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Jesse is an information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. He assists with designing, developing, and implementing security standards and protocols. We're going to talk to our caller, John, in Elgin in just a second. But if you have a question, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. So, John, thank you so much for being patient. What can we help you with?
Yes. Your guest has covered antivirus on Windows products very well, as well as MacBooks, but I use my iPad Air, which is, I don't know, 6-7 years old, for everything, especially a lot of banking and financial work. So what kind of antivirus do I need?
That's a good question. There are products that are available on iOS or iPad and iPhone devices that you can use. There is disagreement whether it's actually needed or not. So one of the things that Apple's really good about is actually curating the App Store. So really the only way you're able to get something onto your iPhone or iPad is by going through the App Store and downloading an app. All of those apps are vetted. So to limit the risk of malware or something bad getting onto your device, that you wouldn't want, which could be used to steal data, use resources on your device for something that it shouldn't be used for. And that's really one of the best ways to kind of protect the information on that device. That in addition to a lot of what Apple has done to protect what can or cannot run on your iPad or iPhone. A few recommendations I'd have right off the bat is don't root your device, which is something that most people will consider doing. And rooting your device allows you to do more with your device, honestly. It allows you to install third-party applications or other things that might otherwise not be available on the App Store. One of the risks with that is those may not be vetted. You may have limited understanding what they're actually going to be doing with your device, and it could be potentially malicious. So if you're using an iPad or an iPhone, make sure your device is kept up to date, that you're updating all the applications that you're using, and be careful about potentially accessing malicious websites or other content. That being said, you can take a look actually at the App Store for different products that you could actually purchase or download. And I would recommend actually looking at the reviews that you get for those different applications. Based upon how Apple's actually restricted what third parties can access from the device, even those antivirus applications may be limited because they don't necessarily have the access to like the roots of the device that allow them to protect it in the same way, which is also a benefit because if no one can access it, that's great because it tries to keep that information secure. And Apple continues to make progress in that direction to limit what applications or vendors can actually access the bare bones of the system. And also limiting that access means that there's less risk should malicious software get on there. So I don't necessarily think that you need to add an additional third-party software application on your iPhone or iPad to protect it. But if you do, I would recommend checking out the App Store, seeing what's available there, and taking a look at user reviews. There are other third-party applications out there from a variety of companies, but I would just be careful about downloading something that doesn't have a lot of reviews in the event that it could also be something, some application doing something you really don't want it to.
There you go.
in order for an antivirus application to do a lot of things, it needs a lot of access to your device, which can also be a risk. So in this case, I would actually say, you know, trust what's built into the iPad or iOS and just keep the device updated and all the apps updated.
Okay, great. Thanks for the question, John. We really appreciate that. You know, when we started out, Jesse, we said we were going to talk about the frustrations of home Wi-Fi. So let's cover that a little bit for those who've been waiting for it. You know, people kind of make mistakes, but let's first of all start with there's a modem and there's a router and we all get them mixed up. So what's the difference and what do they do?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it's so often these days that they actually are the same device because a lot of times you will get your modem, which is really to help convert the signal you're getting from usually cable. It's converting that signal to something that you can use for a normal Ethernet router. Something it kind of looks like a phone cable. It's a little bit bigger, but it uses those network cables to kind of plug in. That modem has really helped to convert that signal. The router is actually there to, one, protect your home internet. So it does have kind of like a firewall at the block. Anyone from the external network connection, really from your internet service provider, from getting in. So it gives you that firewall, but it also allows you to share that one internet connection with multiple devices. And that's usually, even 20 years ago, they say, well, you know, here's your internet. You can only use it for one device. And obviously people, maybe they only did have one device, but that is not the case anymore. Most people have maybe dozens of devices at home. And that router helps to share that one internet connection with one, what they call internet protocol or IP address, with all those different devices. And there's a way it does it, but basically the router helps you share the internet connection. The modem helps to convert usually that cable connection to kind of the standard network connection that we're used to with most day-to-day devices using wireless or what they call RJ45 or Ethernet cables that you physically plug in.
Okay. Well, thanks for that little primer. We do have questions, so we won't stay with that real long, but maybe we can revisit that. And also the ChatGPT, we can talk about it another time too, because, you know, your fans are out there, Jesse. We've got Fred in Menominee who has a question. Hi, Fred.
Talk about it another time too.
Okay. Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Okay. Well, here, actually, I'm calling because my wife was making bread. She has now washed her hands and can talk on the phone.
Happens a lot. Hi, Fred's Hi. Wife.
Hi. My name is Ellen.
Hi, Ellen.
I have a problem with, and it's a Facebook issue, so I don't know if this is something that you want to deal with, but I'm appointed as an administrator for a Friends of the Red Cedar Trail Facebook page. If I'm on Facebook and I get into that piece, I can't get out of it. I can't get back to my own page. And I haven't been able to find out how to do that. I have to turn the computer I have to turn Facebook off, get out of Facebook entirely, wait a couple minutes, and then go back in, and then I'm in my own section. And when and on my cell phone, I can't even do that.
Okay, you got it, Jesse, because I've had to do this number of times, but take it away.
that is a good question. So I haven't actually had to do this in a while. So like any of the kind of delegated features they have in Facebook, because you can have groups. I think we did it for like an online gaming group. So we had a group of people together and different administrators. Normally, what you'd want to do on the website, it's a little bit different. So you might go to the left-hand side where you can select yourself, which has your own name and profile picture, or you can select a group where you're going to be doing other kinds of administration. The first place I'd normally look at is actually going to be normally your picture, which is going to be your profile icon, usually in the upper right-hand corner, where you can basically kind of select the group or the profile that you're going to be acting out of. And I would recommend going there. And usually it has an option like select profile, and that might be your individual user profile, or that might be a group profile. Normally that's going to be the first place I'm going to look to try to change kind of the scope that you're working in. Are you acting as you, or are you acting as you as a group? Which, you know, it gets a little bit weird, but you should be able to select your own personal profile so that you're able to do things as an individual and then basically go through the same step to then act as the group as you need to through the group profile and switch back and forth. And Jill, you can correct me if that looks correct from what you're seeing on your screen.
Well, I've got my phone, so it'll be a little different. So, but basically what you just need to do when you're on Facebook is and this is an iPhone, but down at the very bottom, you'll have a bunch of icons. And at the very last left side or right, you'll see your picture. And there'll be that'll say menu. So you just press menu, and then you just scroll down, and you go to groups. And you can go then, it'll say groups, and it says for you, and then it'll say your groups. And then the ones that you've joined or you manage will pop up. So I can see some that I've created and others that I've just joined. So I'm assuming that's what you're looking for. If you're looking for pages, there's also an icon there that says pages. So it'll list your pages, and then you can go to those pages. Does that make sense? Does that help at all, Ellen?
Excuse me. First of all, I don't have an iPhone. I have an Android.
Okay.
And,
it should
and
be similar.
I have not found that, but I'll keep looking, I guess.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that what you describe about looking at my picture and changing over, I did have that work for me one time about, 9 months ago, but it is no longer the way it was. They changed it.
Okay. Well, like I said, look at your menu bar, and that's basically what you're looking for is menu. So try to find that. So I'm sure someone out there has done. Jesse, you're looking at yours. Go ahead.
Yeah. And I do have an Android.
Okay.
So,
we're covered all the bases here.
And if you are in the group profile, one thing I'd also keep in mind or keep a look at is normally near the top of the screen, if you do see a back arrow, usually that will help you also navigate back to kind of your main homepage if you are in groups. So if I do go to, for example, a group that I administer, I can see that group, but then I can either go back to the three lines, which is your menu, and then select your main page, or you can go back to kind of the main profile page. But those would be the primary things that I recommend going to. Usually the home button should get you, which at least for the Android app is in the lower left. It's just the home icon. Usually that's going to get you directly back to your home profile. But you might also need to use the switch account feature, which when you do go to the main, you know, those three line menu items, you'll see your profile picture in a drop down. You can probably switch the account if it is actually under a different account. But you would see yours and you'd see another one. It would tell you which ones are signed in, and there will be a check mark next to the one that you're currently using. And maybe right now when you look, that's that other page that you're looking at.
Okay. Well, good luck, Ellen. I've found that if I can't figure something out, I'll just Google it, and someone else has had that problem, and they'll tell me how to do it. So you can try that, too, if you need a little few more details there. Let's go next to John in Eau Claire. Hi, John.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
You there?
Yeah.
I just got a quick question about Facebook. I keep getting these unpleasant ads or whatever, people on there, I guess, and we have talked to Apple, and they said it's common. They run through contacts and things like that. It causes issues in the house with my wife. And I've never clicked on anything.
So you're talking an ad that just pops up, or is it actually in your feed, John?
It's in the feed, I guess. I'm not that savvy, but
sure.
It's in the feed, I guess.
Okay. He can form or tell them what kind of ads he wants, right, Jesse?
Yeah, you can go, and I'd always go into the privacy and settings feature in Facebook. If you are getting specific ads that you just don't want or don't like, you can, at least in the upper right, usually it's like three dots.
Yeah, three dots on the ad.
Yeah, please remove this. By default, it does for like 30 days, which honestly isn't really useful if you really want it gone. But I would recommend doing that as much as you can for the ads that you don't like. But under the privacy settings, they do have an option for ads, and you can actually see advertisers, and they call it advertisers you've seen most recently. And so if there are items under there, you can actually hit show more, and it'll show everything that Lisa you've seen recently. And you can just click right there, hide ads, hide ads, hide ads, hide ads, continue going through until they're basically completed. And hopefully that's going to minimize it quite a bit. The platform is still going to try to find a way to give you ads, either the ones that are sponsored by Facebook or based upon how you navigate Facebook or other websites in general. The best thing I can recommend for that is do web browsing with a different device, or use the incognito or private browser options that you have for your device. And that should limit some of the data that's being shared either between applications on your device. So hopefully it reduces the amount of ads that you're going to be seeing. But I would go to the advertisers option under ad preferences and settings. Hopefully that's going to help you with Facebook. But then I think if it does tend to be feeding from different applications or browsers, use a private browser or even use a different device for Facebook or other use. The downside about it, Facebook might also be looking at tagged browser usage actually from your location. So, you know, if you are using a different device to access certain content, and this has been seen with paper ads even, you might be getting ads from somebody else that's in your household, which, you know, may open up other conversations. But it's something I would be, you know, very conscious of. Otherwise, if you do really want to more privatize your web browsing, use a VPN. So if you are using a virtual private network for web browsing and using maybe a different VPN or standard internet usage for Facebook, it's going to limit the amount of data being shared. It all comes down to really that data being shared and Facebook being able to tie down. Are you using the same device or are you using the same internet connection? And if so, I'm going to try to custom deliver that content based upon the information that I have. So your goal then is to just give them less information. VPN would help and private browsers would help.
Okay, good luck on that, John. We can't get rid of the ads, but at least we have options. And I personally like getting those ads from Zulily so I can buy more stuff. Okay, we got an email from Sheila. She asks, is there a fix for a printer that is printing only half pages or leaving pages blank?
Oh, that's a good question. So part of me is curious whether it's going to be the ink is running out, which I'm not sure. One thing I'd probably do, most printers, I would be surprised if there's any that didn't have this. They'll have built-in test pages that you can print, usually from the menu of the device or maybe from the application on your computer. I would run a test print And if it's possible to do it directly from the printer itself, that's how I do it, because it kind of puts the computer out of scope in terms of troubleshooting. If you print a test page and you're still getting either full blank pages or half blank pages, you might be running out of ink. You might have a dry cartridge, or there might be some other issue. If it prints fine with the test page that's built into the printer, but you're having issues printing from your device, it might be an outdated driver or other software that's outdated. But my initial thought is you might actually be running out of ink, or there might be some other kind of issue. If you do have a laser printer, you might also have other things you have to replace outside of toner, which could be drums, rollers, or other features as well. They do have maintenance after certain, it's like a car. So after a certain amount of prints, you might have certain maintenance you have to perform. But hopefully it's just dry ink and you're able to swap out a cartridge. But do print the built-in test page and see what you get.
Okay, thanks so much for that email, Sheila. And one more call here, Clory in Clinton. What's your question?
Yes, recently I just started experiencing a problem with Yahoo Mail where it won't let me attach a document. Doesn't matter if it's a PDF, Word, Excel, it won't let me attach, and it gives a message that says attachment cannot be added to draft.
Is that because it's a draft? I mean, does that make sense, Jesse?
Yeah, it's a good question. Are you using using an application, or are you using like a web browser like Firefox or Chrome?
Microsoft Edge, and I'm using Yahoo Mail.
One thing I might recommend trying just in case, I would try a different web browser just in the event it might be Internet Explorer or Edge. In this case, not Internet Explorer, that's hopefully long gone at this point. I would try Firefox or Chrome if you have it on your device, just to see if there's going to be a difference based upon the application. That will at least tell you whether it is the browser or some other kind of compatibility issue. One thing that you might also see on some different email applications is they might also restrict what kind of applications or what kind of attachments you can use. Another thing to take a look at with your attachment, check the file name. If you have letters or characters that aren't supported by Yahoo Mail, that could be another reason why it wouldn't allow you to add that attachment. So try a different browser and check your file names and try a smaller file name.
Okay, good luck, Chloe. We really appreciate it. And we have run out of time. Thank you so much again, Jesse. Always have such great insight. We've been talking with Jesse LeGru, an information security architect in Madison College of Technology Services Group. And join us again tomorrow when we talk about the benefits of walking and we get an overview of this year's Global Health Symposium that's going to be held right here in Madison on April 4th. Hope you can join us. I'm Jill Nadeau, in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network. Stay well.